Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Here we are in the kitchen. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We're here at the kitchen table, right in the middle of the KHOI Community Radio studio on Douglas Avenue in downtown Ames. We get together here at noon every Tuesday to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, opinions, and heaven knows what we're going to talk about today. We've got a bunch of things to consider. And this is community radio. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
Well, Donna, cold weather is sort of moving in. We're kind of
barely.
Barely. This is a strange, warm fall.
It's November 1st.
Yeah.
We still have a lot of leaves on the trees, some bright colors, finally.
Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely
balmy out.
Right. It's light sweater weather, and those Halloween trick-or-treaters didn't have to wear their bulky winter coats over the costumes.
I still have not had a hard freeze.
Two hard freezes. North of time.
My Mexican sunflowers are still gorgeous.
Now, that's amazing.
I know.
Because I thought they were pretty sensitive about this.
Well, they are, but...
Not this year.
It's just been warm in town.
Not this year. My goodness. Well, I hope everyone had a good Halloween weekend. Yes. I went to an English country dance ball, which was a costume ball, and sort of went as a very low-key harlequin. I had a little hat and a mask and everything, and other folks had things, and we had a fine time, English country dancing. Lots of good parties going on. I think the best costume that I saw for this Halloween, you know, I love concept costumes. A man, friend of mine, wore this long, tall trapezoid shape. Silver in front of him, hanging from his neck, and it had holes all over it, and he had a little American flag stuck in his hat, and it was cheese grater. He was Make America Great Again. don't you just love those kind of costumes? That's
a little play on words. I think that's wonderful.
Well, we did that.
Adult costumes.
I like those. Those are good.
Not X-rated, however.
Not good. No. Well, no. Some of them get a little much, but okay. We're through with that. We're moving on into the cooler time of the year. It's time to think about some warm and wonderful curries, and we'll get some tasty poetry from a special guest later in the show here. But first, a look at a Donald on the Kitchen news item. Tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick. That's a ticker tape. Donna, what did you find?
Okay. Well, the New York Times did an article, independent, non-mediated by industry interests article on GMOs. The headline was, "Doubts About the Promised Bounty of Genetically Modified Crops." Now, this is a big deal because... you know, the Times is not known for their astute agricultural coverage, but we were very happy about it. It says an extensive examination by the New York Times indicates that the debate has missed a more basic problem. It's not about that it might harm you from eating.
Right, but are GMOs safe to eat? And we don't know.
Jury's still out on that. But that the basic problem is genetic modification in the United States and Canada has not accelerated increases in crop yields or led to an overall reduction in the use of chemical pesticides, the two things that it was touted to do. The promise of genetic modification was twofold: by making crops immune to the effects of weed killers and inherently resistant to many pests, they would grow so robustly they would become indispensable to feeding the world's growing population, while also requiring fewer applications of pesticides. So, 20 years ago, Europe largely rejected this genetic modification, and at the same time, the U.S. and Canada went at it full bore. So they have compared the results of the two continents using independent data, as well as academic and industry research, and it shows that the technology has fallen short of the promise. So an analysis by the Times using United Nations data has showed that the United States and Canada have, quote, gained no discernible advantage in yields or foods per acre.
Well, you'd think after – this has been going on a while. We should
– We've got 20 years of this under our belt,
all right.
more or less.
Okay. So we don't have more food and then
okay,
what?
So no yield advantage from conventional.
Okay. Uh-huh.
In fact, I don't think was in this article, but I have read that in times of drought, actually, organic agriculture, because it's really built up the soil, does give a higher yield. So there you go. And then the Times goes on to say, in that same time period, herbicide use has increased in the United States, even as major corn crops like corn, soybeans, and cottons have been converted to modified varieties. And the United States has fallen behind Europe's biggest producer, France, in reducing overall use of pesticides. So
pesticides, huh?
Yeah.
Pesticides, herbicides, two different things.
Two different things, but they're both. I mean, one is to kill weeds and one is to kill insects.
Right. In other words, we are eating more of that, either if we want to or not, because it's going to be onto our food system.
Well, here's what the Times goes on about. Fears about the harmful effects of eating GM foods have proved to be largely without scientific basis. Yeah, well, that I'd say that the jury's still out on that one. But they do say the potential harms from pesticides, however, have drawn researchers' attention. Pesticides are toxic by design. Weaponized versions like sarin were developed in Nazi Germany and have been linked to developmental delays in cancer. Okay, so here's a quote. These chemicals are largely unknown, said David Bellinger, a professor at Harvard University School of Public Health, whose research – this is pretty nasty stuff – whose research has attributed the loss of nearly 17 million IQ points among American children 5 years old and under to one class of insecticides.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
He says, we do natural experiments on a population – he said, referring to exposure to chemicals in agriculture, quote, and wait until it shows up as bad. Now, this is the opposite of the precautionary principle, which is like, you know,
be careful.
Let's wait until it's proven. So the Times is really says to some this outcome was predictable, but the whole point of engineering bug-resistant plants was to reduce insecticide use, but it hasn't.
Yeah, it hasn't. And
herbicide use has gone over the moon, as anybody who lives in Iowa knows. And they also say that the broad yield advantage has not emerged. The Times looked at regional data from the United States FAO, comparing the main genetically modified crops in the United States and Canada, five varieties grown in Western Europe. And the Europeans are coming out ahead. It says, right from our own ISU, Michael Owen, a weed scientist at ISU, he's quoted in the New York Times article, says that while the industry has long said GMOs would save the world, he says they still have not found the magical yield gene. And Jack Heineman, a professor at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, did a pioneering 2013 study comparing transatlantic yield trends using United Nations data and Western Europe, and he said Western Europe has not been penalized in any way for not making genetic engineering one of its biotechnology choices. So there you have it from the New York Times, kind of looking around. That's pretty pretty clear for an American
magazine
to or newspaper to.
In other words,
talk about
somebody's
this.
Making a lot of money off of GMO seeds, but they haven't really delivered on the fantastic yields, and maybe
and they're
a
much, much,
dangerous.
Much more expensive.
Yeah, and maybe it's a little dangerous to be eating and consuming all of these pesticide things. Because as we have discovered on this show, there's lots of little floras and faunas and things that are part of us. And we are part of the flora and fauna, too. So let's be careful out there. News on GMOs. Goodness.
Way to go, New York Times.
Good. Let's consider some food things. I talked with a friend who was back in Ames for a visit. Her name is Geetha Iyer. She was in Ames, a student at ISU a number of years ago, and she was coming back to Ames for a visit, and she's currently living in Panama, where her husband, Martin, is doing some plant research on the effects of climate on plants and tropical plants in particular. And I talked to Geetha earlier this fall. She's a cook and a writer. She talks about where she's been. We'll learn a little bit about the Panama Canal. And she also talks about her food history and her food journey. We're here at the Donalana Kitchen Table. We have a special guest today, Geetha Iyer. She is a graduate of the MFA program in Creative Writing and the Environment here at Iowa State University, and she's back in town. Where are you currently? You are a world traveler. Where are you, Geetha? Welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show. Right now, I'm based in Panama City, Panama. I've been there for about 2 years now, and I will be there for 3 years more. But I happen to be also en route to a trip to Oregon, where I will be at a writing residency at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology for about 4 months. So I will be stateside for a while.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. And Panama isn't quite like Iowa, but it's probably a little damper, isn't it?
No? Oh, my goodness, much damper. It's very humid, and we have two seasons, a rain season for about, let's say, 8 months or so, and then a dry season for about 4 months. And because this year is a La Niña year after the El Niño, it's been quite a heavy rain season. So, it's been interesting living in a place where you don't really get to see, you know, weather change all that much. And it's good to be back here and see fall colors.
So welcome back to mm-hmm. Iowa. You were, and I were talking a little bit more about, environmental issues in there. And you mentioned the Panama Canal mm-hmm. and the fact that it isn't just water, there's stuff around it. Can you talk to a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So one of the things that's really interesting about the Panama Canal is that, you know, it's sort of described as a literal green business. The canal allows ships to transit carrying goods from, you know, basically all over the world, and it relies on a freshwater system for it to operate. So all of commerce sort of depends on this freshwater system, and the freshwater system in turn depends on the watershed surrounding the canal.
So if I understand, mm-hmm. it's not seawater coming
no,
in.
No, no.
Oh, okay.
So that's one of the really cool things about the canal. It was constructed by the Americans, and it's sort of built on a lock system. So you have this very narrow channel, and you have a series of locks that raises ships up into a freshwater sort of dammed lake river system that goes through the country. And if you don't have enough rainfall, you don't have high enough lake levels to allow ships to transit. And so last year, because of the El Niño, there was a drought. And so at some point they had to say, well, you can't let ships transit anymore because there's not enough water to let them through. So if you don't really have forests and trees around in the watershed to sort of help, you know, channel and retain water, you kind of ruin the system that allows sort of commerce and ecology to exist in the country.
So this should be a big concern, not just for people who think they're saving birds and trees and things. This is things that are making worldwide commerce happen.
Yeah, pretty much.
We need the watershed for that sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
too.
Yep, definitely.
Very good, very good. So tell me about your writing.
Okay. So I'm primarily a fiction writer. I tend to focus on short fiction, but I also write nonfiction and poetry. And I have a background in the natural sciences, so a lot of my writing sort of taps into, sort of things that I've read about in, scientific texts, things I learned in biology classes, things that sort of fascinate me. And so that's sort of like where I'm inspired and what I like to write about. And so yeah, I do that sort of work. Mm-hmm.
Do you have something to share with us today?
Yes, I do. I have a poem here. It's actually an excerpt from a much longer poem that's about sort of my connection to my food history, because I'm from the south of India. And so I was thinking a lot about sort of the kind of foods that we make, how we learn to make them, and also about sort of like the languages, particularly my mother tongue, Tamil. It's a South Indian language from Chennai, which used to be called Madras when I was growing up. And so it's sort of like in learning how to make dishes from my family history, I was also sort of tapping into the language in which those dishes were conveyed to me, and sort of, relearning my language in a way, because most of what I do is speak in English, but I miss, sort of thinking and speaking in Tamil as well. And so this is a part of that poem. The poem's called Mapping the Tongue. It was published in the Mid-American Review, and the part that I'm going to read to you is part six. I guess I might have to describe why there are six parts. The poem is organized around how South Indians sort of classify tastes. Like, you commonly think of tastes as sort of, sweet, sour, salty, spicy, and maybe umami for some people here, for like savoriness. So there are six tastes in India, in the way that we classify them. We have bitterness, sweetness, sourness, saltiness, spiciness, and something that's harder to describe, astringency, sort of, dryness. And so the part of the poem that I'm going to read to you is about dryness. There are a couple of words in there that are in Tamil, and one of them is Amamma, which is my grandmother. So this is a poem that's about her and some of the stuff that I learned from her. So part six. Torpe, that which remains. Next time you bite into a still raw banana, consider how its meat clings like drying glue to each pink bud of flesh on your tongue. Or drink from that forgotten cup of black tea left by the stovetop, the wick of the thread sprouting from the teabag, now tanned and hardened, the liquid like bone meal, a rasp inside your mouth. Or go to Madras, where they harvest heavy lobes of purple-red banana hearts. Shuck the spiraled sepals. Each sheath unveils banana flowers, pale as baby fingers. Slice them away from the stem. Dice the flowers. Let the pieces soak in a large orange plastic bowl filled with water from the tap. Remember, Amamma had a trick for making precious little stretch, curried banana flowers with ground lentils for bulk. She said to eat slowly, parting meat from grit. Even today, the memory lingers. Mother tongue, like after apples, filming the teeth.
It's lovely. It was lovely. Did you say what this whole poem is called?
The whole poem is called Mapping the Tongue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That was lovely. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
One of the reasons why I wrote this poem was because I'm interested in sort of classification systems, in sort of the ways in which we sort of categorize things. And I learned when I was talking to my aunt and uncle at some point in Chennai about Thorpe, the part of the poem that I just read to you. Like, I know that feeling. I know about, the dryness in your mouth from eating apples and from various other foods. I didn't know the word for it. And so it was, sort of a learning process to find that word and then to find sort of how Indians think about food, about this sort of balance between these six tastes, these six sort of textures. And so, so that's part of where the poem came from. Thank you.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM. This is community radio for the heart of Iowa. Warm thoughts and warm tastes. Now back to my interview with Geetha Iyer. There is a wonderful world of tastes out there. And on the show, we like to talk about different kinds of tastes and people who love different kinds of taste. Today, we're going to be talking about curry. So, Geetha, you were born in southern India, but you've traveled a lot since then, and you bring a wonderful history of cooking and spices and knowledge of things. So tell me about your cooking history.
Okay, so I come from a South Indian family from Chennai, but we moved to Mumbai now before I was born, and so we're sort of, you know, Mumbai Madrasi people. It's sort of like hard to define because people tend to travel a lot, and so a lot of my cooking heritage comes from South India, but there's also a lot of, you know, mix with northern cuisines, and so that's sort of what I grew up eating. I myself did not learn how to cook until I was about 23, because I spent the majority of my life thinking, I don't want to do this because it seems like this is what women do, and then this is all that they do, and I don't want to end up being that sort of person. And I was quite ashamed to find out that many of my friends here in the United States, a lot of them were vegetarian or vegan, they were making these exquisite dishes for potlucks and things, and I would come in with Chips Ahoy and Tostitos, and it just made me feel really embarrassed that I have, you know, a lot of food that I could contribute, but it's stuff that my mom knows how to make and not I. And so I spent the next years sort of, you know, calling my mom up on Skype and saying, can you tell me how to make this or that? And so learning again all of the stuff that had just sort of like happened in the background and that I took for granted. And so,
your taste buds knew it. Your nose knew it.
Yeah.
But you did. I can't think of a better use for Skype. And uh-huh. you were Skyping your mom back in. She was in
Dubai.
In Dubai.
Yeah. So I grew up in the United Arab Emirates, and so you know my mom still lived there at the time, and so I would be Skyping her from Michigan, or actually not from Michigan, from Florida, and then again from Iowa, and so I'd ask her how to make all of these things that I remember loving, and then having to find them here, which is not as difficult as you would think, because there are a lot of people who really enjoy eating cuisine from from various parts of the world, and so. So, for example, Wheatfield Co-op has a lot of really great, you know, spice selections, and the Asian food stores here have a lot of things that you wouldn't be able to find in a Hy-Vee, for example. And so I started reconstructing my childhood.
So did it work?
It did. It's not quite as good as what my mom does, because she sort of got it down to a science, but it's been really nice to sort of learn that I can, you know, recreate the things that I miss, particularly like in wintertime when I miss hot, spicy food, and when I need to be comforted, you know, it's really nice to know that I can do that myself now.
That's wonderful. So tell me about curry, and what makes a curry? It seems there's all different kinds.
So curry is, if you ask an Indian, curry is a complicated thing. Curry is different depending on who you speak to in India. In the south, where I'm from, curry tends to be what we refer to in terms of dry vegetables that are sort of mixed with spices. In the north, it tends to be vegetables in a wet gravy. But curry, I also like to think of as a verb, because it's not necessarily like the combination of spices that you put in, but the fact that you are making a mix of spices to go with any vegetable dish that you have. And so the curry powder that you find in a supermarket is really sort of the simplest, blandest excuse for the vast variety of things that you can do when you decide to curry vegetables.
Oh, so the curries, the little bottle that says curry, mm-hmm. would kind of like be being
putting ketchup on everything.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like ketchup instead of the wide variety of sauces you can make with tomatoes. So, yeah. And I think that one of the main problems with that, with like the curry you buy in a store, is that it tends to over-dominate with turmeric. And turmeric tends to be sort of like, you know, more of a, you use it with restraint. And so you pick different things to use in curry. There's one other thing that curry is that mostly only Indians know about. It's also a tree. It forms these leaves, the sort of dark glossy green leaves on a stem. They smell like nothing that it can really describe. It's, I guess, like the closest thing that I would come to is sort of like a mix between juniper and pepper. It's sort of oils, really fragrant oils. Sort of like this mild, crispy spiciness.
And these are the leaves.
Yeah,
the
these
tree.
Are the leaves. Yeah, and so this is something that, you know, it's a tree that's native to India. And my mom had one in her garden in Dubai. And so every summer or so, she would harvest leaves off of it and dry it on, you know, like a large table of curry leaves that she'd let air dry. And then she'd powder them and then send packages to me, to my sister. And that's one of those spices that is relatively hard to get here in the United States, but is absolutely wonderful to use in cooking.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. And on this tree, there's a fruit, too, or a nut?
Yeah,
or?
I believe there's a fruit. I believe it produces small white flowers and little, I think they're sort of greenish, brownish fruit. I think you can eat the flowers. I'm not sure if you can eat the fruit, but the leaves are the thing that you primarily use.
The leaves. Who would have known?
Yeah.
That's great. So tell me about some of your favorite tastes. You mentioned you're a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. So you know how to put this stuff with vegetables.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, in keeping with sort of how you use curries, sort of the basic stuff that we do at home, the simplest sort of curried dish that you can make involves just sort of sautéing mustard seeds in oil and then throwing in your diced vegetables into that and then adding some chili powder and some turmeric, about, you know, a half teaspoon of turmeric and, say, a teaspoon of chili powder or more, depending on your spice levels. And so that's sort of like a very basic dish that is incredibly satisfying. Anything that you do on top of that is just sort of a variation. And so you can throw in coriander seed powder. You can throw in cumin seeds. You can throw in cloves, bay leaves, cinnamon, pretty much anything that you can think of in your spice rack. And that sort of like alters and varies the flavor. And so a lot of the dishes that I like to make that come from India are variations on that sort of like basic set of spices.
You make the curry, the spices are cooked separately from, or first, or during, or?
It depends. So if you have woody spices that you want to impart, you know, some flavor but not over-dominate the dish, you put them into the oil first before you put in the vegetables.
What kind of oil?
Any oil would work. I mean, normally we use vegetable oil or sunflower oil, but here I tend to use olive oil just because, you know, it's the easiest to get. Mm-hmm. Milder oils that don't have much flavor work, because then whatever spices you put in sort of impart their flavor into that oil. And so with the woodier spices that you just want to sort of mildly flavor your food with, you just let it saute whole in the oil before you put in your other stuff. If you're using powdered spices, that sort of gives a more complex, sort of deeper flavor. And when it cooks in with your vegetables, it sort of soaks into the flesh of the vegetables. So normally you'd put that powder in after you put the vegetables so that it doesn't get singed in the oil. Instead, it just sort of soaks into the juices of the food. So that's what I tend to do. Mm-hmm. And then midway, of course, you know, you throw in onions, garlic, or ginger, variations on those depending on what kind of dish you're making, to sort of add more flavor to what you're making.
Oh, it seems like all these dishes delight the nose, delight the eyes. It's really, really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Speak about heat. When you get to the Midwest here, we're always so afraid that it's way too spicy. Yeah, it's way too hot. Mm-hmm. Heat, chili powders are an acquired taste.
But
I think it helps to sort of, you know, you build up a tolerance to it. And like for someone like me, you build up a tolerance for it from when you're like a 1 year old. And so you can handle quite a lot of spice. But what I've found when I've tried to cook for people who can't tolerate spice, if I don't use chili powder, I end up using more of the other ingredients, so for example, cumin and coriander seed and clove and things like that. And so you start bringing out all of these other flavors in the food, and that's just as good. You don't need to burn your tongue off to enjoy a dish. It's just one other way of, you know, appreciating food. And so it's possible to sort of minimize how much chili powder you use and still get, you know, heartiness out of a dish.
That's great.
And the other thing, you know, the chili powder that Indians tend to use the most is Kashmiri chili powder, which tends to be a milder chili by our standards, and it provides as much color as it does flavor. So a lot of times you add it for the redness that it gives to food. And I think that that's important. Like the color of the food that you're eating can be just as soothing as the food itself, you know.
So. Kashmiri chilies. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Look for mm-hmm. that then. Good. So were you a picky eater when you were a young kid?
Unfortunately, very picky. Yes. I spent a long time saying there were certain vegetables I just could not eat, onions, carrots, peas. And so I think when I was little, I only ate two vegetables. One was okra and the other was, it's called tindli in Hindi. It's a relative of the zucchini and the cucumber. It's a tiny little cucurbit. It's about the size of, say, a thumb. And it's delicious. And so my mom would curry those two and give them to me in a lunchbox to eat at school. And that's all I ate. I used to be known as the Bindi Fry kid or the Tindli kid. These are sort of the names that you use for these vegetables. But yeah, as I grew up, I realized that a lot of the reasons why I didn't like food was because I was suspicious of what they looked like. And, you know, when you actually taste them, they're perfectly fine. So, yeah.
So you had a lot of learning to do as you grew up, and
yes,
that's wonderful.
And a lot of apologizing to do to my mother.
So, very good.
Yeah.
But you did connect up with her again, and
yes.
You did learn very good things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you leave us with off the top of your head, you talked a little bit about the general curry and a quick recipe.
A quick recipe. What's in season right now?
Zucchini, squash, potatoes, onions, leeks, garlic, kale, greens.
Yeah. Okay.
How's that? Try that.
Well, any of those vegetables.
And?
but
something for a fall taste.
For a full taste?
Fall taste.
Oh, for a fall taste. Well, it's always nice to have something hearty and warm. And so I guess one thing that you could do is make a sort of a curry, like, you know, curry up some vegetables in a stew, sort of like a gravy dish. And start by chopping up onion and garlic into, you know, fine pieces. And on a saucepan, warm up some oil and throw in a teaspoon of black mustard seeds. Black mustard seeds pop when they hit hot oil, and when they do, they release mustard oil into the oil. And so, you know, they provide some texture and flavor to the dish. Once the mustard seeds start to splutter as they're popping, toss in the onion so that it can start getting, you know, cooked and browned. And in the meantime, you can start chopping up whatever other vegetables you have. Normally, what I like to do is chop the vegetables that take the longest time to cook first. So, say, carrots and potatoes and things like that. Dice them up, and then when your onions are sort of, you know, starting to get tender, throw in the garlic, let that soften a little bit, and then throw in those rooty, you know, hard to the vegetables that take longer to cook. And then you can start chopping up some of your lighter vegetables. Usually I like to have at least something that'll impart gravy. So, for example, we used okra. And so you can use okra, you can use tomatoes, you can use zucchini, anything that sort of has, you know, liquid in it that sort of like releases that into the food as you cook it. And then as your harder vegetables are starting to get soft, you put those other vegetables in. And then around that time, you can start throwing in your spices. And so the simplest thing you can do is to put in about a half teaspoon of turmeric. It's considered an antiseptic, and it helps sort of like, you know, lower bacterial levels. And so we put it into all our food. And so, you know, it never hurts to put in a little. Putting in too much makes it dominate the flavor of food. So you don't really want to use more than about a half teaspoon. And then you put in chili powder, as much as or as little as you like. If you don't want to use chili powder, you can use pepper, and that gives you a little bit of piquance without, you know, the incredible spice. And then if you want to make sort of, I guess, if you want to have some fun, coriander seeds and fennel seeds are some of my favorite spices to use. I grind them up in a spice grinder, about, say, a tablespoon of coriander seed and, say, about a teaspoon and a half of fennel. It really depends on how much you enjoy those flavors.
You're talking more more quantity than I would use, but it sounds delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
go
absolutely.
For it.
I mean, if for a family meal, a tablespoon to a teaspoon is actually, you know, I think perfect an amount to put in. And so, yeah, you grind up those spices, and then you put them in with your vegetables that are releasing liquids into your dish. And then they just sort of blend in with the powder, and then you just let it cook. And I usually let it cook only to the point where, say I put in, like, a bean is one of the last vegetables that I would put in, because it's sort of tender, and I want it to keep its crispness. And so I like to have some of my vegetables sort of have that bite to them. And then, you know, and then you take it off the heat, and it's ready to eat. If you want variations on that, you can use tamarind sauce, or you can use coconut milk to create sort of a thicker gravy.
Oh, yes.
So tamarind sauce is sour, so it creates a really delicious sour dish. And if you use tamarind sauce, you want to put it in earlier. So maybe when you start putting in your potatoes, you know, the harder vegetables, so that it sort of cooks in with the heat. You get the raw taste of the tamarind out of that. And then coconut milk, it doesn't take much time to heat at all. So you only want to put it in when you want to have it soak into your vegetables. So you put it about midway through cooking. And that creates a sort of like creamy, milky, just sort of, you know, it's hard to describe. It's just a lovely flavor. And so, yeah.
And these are all lovely curry tastes. Mm-hmm. Like you said, curry is a verb, mm-hmm. too. So there you go.
There you go.
So, well, thank you. Mm-hmm. My taste buds are dancing around here, and it all sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. Great.
One thing that I discovered, if you don't have a mom you can call on Skype, there are a lot of people on YouTube who put up videos of them cooking. And so I found a number of, you know, Indian grandmas and aunties and people on YouTube who are in their kitchens making these dishes. And so, yeah, just, you know, Google on YouTube a dish that you're curious about making, and someone will have made it and shared the details with you. And so, you know, you have a hand.
That sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. Good things to try. Mm-hmm. Good things to taste. Thank you for joining us here in the kitchen today. Thank you, Geeta. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOI Community Radio, and we are here at the kitchen table. We're talking about curry. Curry is a verb, so we just learned. We talked to Geeta Iyer about curry and the Indian tradition of using wonderful spices. You cook curry?
Yeah, I do. I actually set up this funny challenge for myself last year. There's an event that I do every year in March for about 300 people. And we decided this year, that year, last year, we were going to do Indian food. And I went, oh, dear. Because it was one of the first cuisines that I really learned of, but I haven't been to India for 40 years, and I don't cook it that much, although this time of year is a wonderful time to cook curries. I cooked curries last night. I roasted a squash, and I had some pork stock from my pig's feet that I was cooking. But then I added in some different curry ingredients, and like coriander, and, of course, turmeric that she mentioned, and a few other things. So what I did for this big dinner that we were doing, we kind of did an outline of structures we always do, like two meat dishes, you know, five or six salads, some starches, da-da-da-da-da. And then I went, okay, I'm going to just order like 1 pound bags of all the seasonings that I use, because a curry is a different mix. Like every family will have their own, you know, like Gita was talking about, the ones that she uses mm-hmm. in her family. And, of course, there's some differences between Northern Indian cooking and Southern Indian cooking. And I like both of them. So here's a list of all of the spices that I just put into the kitchen to make this dinner. And I must say, I just kind of – you don't want all your dishes to taste the same, nor do you want all of your dishes to be kind of soppy, especially not when it's on a sort of white tablecloth buffet. You know, you need texture. You need all these things. So here are the spices that coriander, which Gita mentioned. Now, also coriander seed, which is ground in Indian food, is the seed of the cilantro plant. So both the green leaf is often used for fresh herbs, and then the seed is quite common. And I have to say, coriander seed goes really well with winter squash. I just did another larger dinner for a nonprofit, and all I did was seed the squash, cut it in wedges, and then I made a mixture where I took olive oil, salt, black pepper, and a lot of coriander seed, and I just crusted it, rubbed them, you know, on all the exposed parts, roasted in the oven, and they were really great. So coriander is really, really one of my favorite spices. In fact, when I first smelled it, I was, in my 20s, and I said, you know, this is so good. I'm going to make sachets out of it and put it in my underwear drawer.
Good. That's a point of honor there.
Yes, yeah, it smells really good. Yeah. Okay, so another one that she talked about were mustard seeds. And they do come in yellow, black, and brown, mm-hmm. which are each slightly different. I noticed it was interesting that she emphasized the black, which is fine. Then some more favorites. Cardamom, which has to be used judiciously but is very good, especially if you're putting it in with cinnamon. And there are, you know, I use different kinds. I use three kinds of cinnamon as well. The Ceylon cinnamon, which is a soft stick cinnamon, and also in Mexican cuisines is known as canela. Then there's there's a hotter, spicier one, which is a Vietnamese. Now, you have to realize curries actually go all through, like there's Malaysian curries. There's they go kind of all through the southern tropical regions mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So there's cinnamons, fennel seeds, ginger, of course, and then cayenne or chilies and black pepper. And sometimes I use both. Cumin, of course, is quite common. Nutmeg and or mace. Clove, which you have to use very carefully. Fenugreek seeds. Turmeric, which she says is ubiquitous, and it's true. And she was talking about its antiseptic qualities. Turmeric is also a great anti-inflammatory. And saffron is another one that you can use a little bit. And then in the south of India, where it's more tropical, they tend to use coconut, as she mentioned, coconut milk, citruses, and then tamarind, which is also sour like a citrus. And she also didn't talk much about rice. Basmati rice is, of course, the Indian rice. And it's pretty easy to find. I like to cook with brown basmati rice because I like the whole grain. And the other thing she did not talk about, which is, I think, very, very central to Indian cooking and has become quite popular amongst Americans lately. We are having a ghee craze.
Ghee.
Ghee.
As in G-H-E-E.
ghee. G-H-E-E. So ghee is basically clarified butter. So all you do is you melt it in a pan and you let it come to a slow boil. And it will start to bubble up and then it will die down. The whole process takes about 20 minutes. And what happens as it's boiling is the oil separates from the milk solids in the butter, and the milk solids drop to the bottom of the pan, and then you pour the oil off through a strainer and a couple of layers of cheesecloth. And what you're doing is you're taking all of the milk product, the lactose parts, out of the butter. It was originally a way to preserve. You know, when you don't have refrigeration, if you take all the milk out of the butter and you have nothing left but oil, it's shelf stable.
Well, that's why. Now I know these.
I don't know why people are eating ghee. It came up as an ingredient in like these things called power coffees. So you put something about the medium chain triglycerides or something that are supposed to be very good for you. I mean, ghee is, I think it's very healthy, and ghee and or butter are, I have to say, they're my secret weapons when I'm doing Indian food. It just makes everything taste really, really good.
Oh, that's good to know. There's lots of taste to explore. And what I was talking to our engineer here, Evan.
He said, oh, yeah, Evan has a cool recipe.
Yeah, you can have that curry taste on lots of things. What do you put it on, Evan?
Oh, absolutely. So one of my favorite things to do when I'm cooking at home is I like to make kind of non-traditional pizzas. And something that I've been playing around with recently is a chicken tikka masala pizza. So taking kind of a northern cuisine. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Taking kind of a northern India-style curry and putting that on dough and baking it. It's very delicious. Usually start off by marinating that chicken, you know, toss it in some yogurt with some spices.
Is another big part of northern Indian cooking.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, mine changes on a day-to-day basis, but usually I'll put in some turmeric, some chili powder, cumin, pepper, paprika. Let that sit for a little bit. Then while that's marinating, give or take hour or two, go ahead and make my tikka masala base for my sauce. So that's usually a kind of tomato cream sauce that uses a spice blend called garam masala to flavor it, as well as a little bit of curry powder and whatever else happens to be hanging out on my spice rack in the moment.
Now, I'm familiar with garam masala as a powdery thing. What in the world is in that?
All right. Well, it's a spice blend, and there are about as many variations as there are palates, but one of the more traditional blends is usually black and white peppercorns, cloves, cinnamon, nutmeg, black and green cardamom pods, bay leaf, and cumin. This is all stuff that you can just buy.
Didn't you say that garam means, so hot and masala is mixed, hot mix,
yeah,
basically.
A hot mixture of spices, essentially. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, take that, use it as my sauce, toss it on top of I usually use a naan crust, so that's your sort of Indian flatbread. Very delicious, doughy, chewy.
Where are you getting your naan around here?
Oh, I make it myself. That's the best way to do it, I think, is just make it from scratch.
Amazing. I'm coming to your house for dinner.
Oh, you ought to sometime. Nothing like a
fresh naan.
Yes,
very good. Oh, absolutely. Toss that in the oven at about 400 for 20 to 25 minutes, and top it with, I like to do slices of red onion, very thinly sliced jalapeno, and then some cilantro to garnish. I find this really delicious. And you stick the chicken on it. Oh, of course. That and the red onion, you know.
Sounds delicious.
Probably save the cilantro for after. Make sure it doesn't wilt in the oven.
Very good. So, curry on pizza. Curry on a naan pizza.
And curry is, I love curry in the winter.
We're thinking warm. We're thinking wonderful, and we're thinking, those nice, warmish sort of foods. Curry is a good thing to explore. Yes, well, there's some upcoming things here in Central
tonight
Iowa.
We got a big event.
The author Margaret Atwood is lecturing tonight.
The famous author. Yes,
at the ISU Memorial Union in the Great Hall. Do go and hear her. She's pretty dandy. Yes, and the Ames Public Library this weekend is beginning on Friday, is their book sale. That's good. Oh, I do like Margaret Atwood. I just finished a some short stories of her. I think it's a rather new collection. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's an older collection. But anyway, that collection of Margaret Atwood short stories was called The Stone Mattress. But she's also known for things like The Handmaid's Tale. And, oh, very good. Science fiction.
Which was also a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah. Science fiction, speculative fiction, to make us think about ourselves and our society and all sorts of things like that. Yes.
Should be a fascinating lecture.
Yes. We talked today about curry with Geeta Iyer. She's a writer and a cook, and she was back in Ames after living in Panama now, but she's been around the world. She had some things to share. She talked about taste. Hope you're feeling warm and cozy. Earlier, we heard music by David Cantini. He plays flutes, woodwinds, all sorts of things. Good music to move your feet to. And we'll go out with a blast from the past. There's an Ames band that was around in the late 70s called the Pool Hall Waltz Band. Pretty darn dandy band. They played different places like the Skunk River Cafe and Dugan's, you remember those, Thumbs Up, Maintenance Shop. They were at peace rallies and all things like that. Good people playing good music. And they're going to be playing, or we'll listen to a song called Easy Chair here. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name's Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor.
And a recipe to boot.
And a recipe, yes. The Pool Hall Waltz Band, they're no longer, but some of their tunes still exist, but with a band called the El Skunko Rio Trio, if you ever happen to catch them. Now, El Skunko refers to the river, of course, but trio, it's kind of loose. Sometimes it's three people, sometimes it's 9 or 10 people, but El Skunko Rio Trio plays this kind of tunes, too. So, eat good food and enjoy life.
Pack up your troubles, pick up your tent, 'cause you ain't going nowhere. Ride behind. Tomorrow's the day my bride's gonna come. Oh, no, now we gonna fly down in that easy chair. I say buy me a flute and a gun that shoots, a tailgate and substitutes. Strap yourself.